So I'm Allison Wilson. I'm the director of Critical Care and Trauma Institute at West Virginia University. We are one of two level one trauma centers in the entire state. There are a total of about 44 hospitals in the state. About 30 of those participate in our trauma system. We have two level ones, two level twos in the state, one level three. Everything else is a level four or a level, like, we don't know what sort of thing. Like, they just, they're great people, but they're very, very small. And so we're used to getting patients from far, far away. There's parts of West Virginia, about 50% of the state has no cell phone coverage, so that limits EMS. There's a big mountain ridge that it's not as tall as the Rockies, but it inhibits flight, so 50% of the time the helicopter can't fly and essentially bisects the state in half. So our pre-hospital times from the southern part of the state can be anywhere between 4 to 6 hours, which I recognize if you're from Alaska or Montana, that's nothing. But if you're from the eastern part of the U.S., that's pretty substantial. So what I'm going to do is have everyone introduce themselves, name where you're from, and then a little bit about where you're working so everybody can kind of relate to where you are compared to where they are. So go ahead.
Hi, I'm Sue Long, and I'm from Buckhannon, West Virginia, which is an hour and a little bit south of her. And I'm in a little 25-bed critical access hospital, which is a level 4 trauma center. And luckily, we do have a good trauma system in our state, so a lot of our trauma patients can get flown directly to the trauma center, often from the field, which may be good for them. I'm great. This is be a good panel to talk about that, maybe. And but, you know, we do have a blood bank. We have a couple of ICU beds that have ventilators, but that's about it, and not much more than that. So we're kind of limited in what we can handle.
How many surgeons do you have?
Two.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Rick?
My name's Rick Sidwell. I am from Des Moines, Iowa. If you're an Iowa kid, then being in Des Moines is being in the big city. I do work at a ACS verified level one trauma center. Over the course of my time, I've worked at level 1, 2, 3, and 4 centers, and we're going to have a little fun.
Rick, I am a little hurt. Where's your hat?
It's right there.
Ah, okay.
Do I need...
You don't need to wear it, but you have to have it up there, right? All right. It's got to be up there. This is Rick's sort of trademark when he's... when he's at the meetings, right? We got to make sure that the big city guys know that we little people are there, right? Or else they forget it. So we remind them very often. We may be small, but mighty, right? So, all right, next.
My name's Adam Deutschman. I left my overalls at home. But I am a general surgeon in Salmon, Idaho. That's along the Continental Divide between three mountain ranges. On the 45th parallel, my hospital is a 19-bed critical access hospital. We've got two ORs. We have only family practice trained ER docs and sometimes PAs and nurse practitioners. We don't have any platelets. I'm 140 miles from the nearest trauma center, ACS verified level 2 center. We are not a verified ACS center. We're level 4 for our state, but we're a fledgling state in our trauma system. Mm-hmm. My county is the landmass size of Connecticut, and we have 1.5 people per square mile. We're often impaired in transport by weather and distance and expense and resource.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a mountain range you have to go over, or
flat? There are only two roads that leave our county, and it's over a 7,000-foot mountain pass.
Okay. All right. Next.
Hi. I'm Matt Conway. I'm from the socialist state of Vermont. it's a small state, rural, about 600,000 people. I'm from mid-state in a 100-bed hospital. We have four general surgeons. We have two tertiary facilities that are level one that are about equidistant, a little over 70 miles. One of them does have a helicopter which can fly less than about 40% of the time. So That means most of our traumas go by land, usually 2 hours transport over basically two-lane roads. We have 4 general surgeons in town. We have ICU capability. We have a blood bank, which has 1 4-pack of platelets.
Has how many? I'm sorry?
One four-pack of platelets.
How many PRBCs?
Probably a dozen.
Okay. And any FFP or cryo?
Yeah, we have FFP, no cryo.
Okay.
And that's about us, really.
Great. Yeah. Dr. Knight?
My name is Jennifer Knight, and I work with Allison at West Virginia University, and I'm the trauma director for our Level 1 Trauma Center, and finishing out the surgeons up here from West by God, Virginia.
We're very proud of our state. So, all right, so who can relate to practicing in a situation such as myself and Dr. Knight?
So level one, okay. Or level two?
Level one in an eastern area with some mountains and some geography challenges, but still access to care. Okay, good. Who can relate to Dr. Sidwell? Iowa, bigger city. We're in a small, we only have 50,000 people in our town. So bigger city, but gets a lot of referrals to them from other areas. So a few. Okay, great. How about, this sounded like you're a very brave soul. How about who relates to him with Sam in Idaho and whatnot and very limited stuff, okay? And how about here? A little bit bigger hospital, maybe a few more doctors, some blood, but not much. All right, great. Good. So with that in mind, what we're going to do is we're going to go through some cases, and we're going to talk about how we would manage it. So I was telling them, I said, just relax. This is great. Now, they haven't seen any of these cases. They've not seen a single image. And I said, you know, don't worry. This is just like taking oral boards just in front of a bunch of people. Right? So instead of the two-person people sitting in the hotel with the lights in your eyes, we're just going to
have everybody.
We're just going to have everybody, but we won't put the bright lights in their eyes, right? So it'll all be fine. And then some rules of the game, right? So we will try to trade off different things. You know, everybody is going to have their opportunity to answer. If no one answers the question posed, then you will be voluntold, okay? And I am in charge, so that means there's no ability for a coup. Coup attempts will be strongly reined in very rapidly.
This sounds like my work environment every day.
Oh. We'll have a little talk about that bonus you were going to get a little later. All right, so here we go. So we talked about where everybody's from. We're going to talk about some pre-hospital considerations. How many of you are EMS medical directors as well? Okay, so some? Okay. So we'll talk about some pre-hospital considerations. We're going to talk really, I don't like talking about rural versus urban, because I'll tell you what, I can do, and our data shows that we have just as many resources in our little town of 50,000 as a level one ACS center. We have just as many resources and provide just as good care, if not better, than some of the major urban trauma centers, you know, Penn and Shock and all those things. So what we're really going to focus in on, resource limited and resource rich, right? Because you could be located in a cornfield, but if you have hybrid rooms and every subspecialist and ECMO and all that stuff, it doesn't matter, right? It's resource limited and resource rich. And in this, we're not only going to talk about management, we're going to talk about some technical tips as to how to do some of these things. And what I'd like you to think about as we manage these cases is, if you're at one of these smaller hospitals that may be very resource limited, what can you do? And then let's have the conversation with those of us who are on the receiving end about what should expectations be and how can we support. And that's really going to be how this goes. All right, any questions from the panel? Going once, going twice. All right, sold. All right, here we go. So here's the first case. So 52-year-old man working on a farm. He's clearing the brush from the fence line, and the tractor stalls. He's using a brush hog. He slips on the grass, and his leg goes under the brush hog. He's struck by the blade in the popliteal fossa and in the lower extremity. It's packed with a shirt. He packs it He is in a place where he does have a cell phone that works. That's a bonus. And so he calls his wife and at the same time also calls EMS. And he has the presence of mind to try to put direct pressure and pack the wound. So in your situation, what do people think as far as how long it's going to take for EMS to get? Who wants to field that one? Yeah, go ahead.
I'll take that. So our state has 1,800 EMS providers in the whole state.
How many are volunteer?
About 90% of them are volunteer.
Yeah. Okay.
We only have an EMS advanced unit, so no paramedics. They can't give very many drugs. They could drug assist for other folks. So they are volunteers. They have regular jobs. And when they're on call, they I think they have about a 15-minute response time to the ambulance barn. That's mm-hmm. what they call it, is the ambulance barn. And then they get together. In my environment, it's possible that the wife in the pickup truck would be delivering the patient instead of waiting for EMS.
Okay. So how many can relate to the wife in the pickup truck picking them up as opposed to waiting on EMS? Yep, fair number. How many of you have, and for the rest of you on the panel, how many of you know the percentage of BLS versus ALS providers in your region? Rick?
So for Iowa, it's a mix. If you're in the urban area, it's all ALS and paramedic. And so those urban areas are Quad Cities, Des Moines, Mason City, Cedar Rapids, Sioux City. Every place outside of that, it is largely volunteer and ranging basic to paramedic level. My first thought when I saw this, my first thought was that's a red mower and it should be a green mower and he wouldn't have had a problem to begin with. That was my first thought. But my second thought is this is who's doing Stop the Bleed stuff? Who's doing Stop the Bleed education with
their
communities?
There we go. That's the point
we're trying to get. Were you already getting to this?
We are.
Because before we even get to how is this person getting to the hospital, I see the PACS with the shirt. That's nice. But if you're in one of these areas, that's got to be part of our responsibility is helping the medics, helping the wife, teaching your church, et cetera.
So how many of you know what the Stop the Bleed program is? Good. That's good. So most, but not all. So stopthebleed.org, controlbleeding.org. I would encourage you to look it up if you're not doing it. We as trauma leaders need to be teaching this. This is the CPR of this next century. It's teaching the civilians and teaching people how to identify and how to then treat significant bleeding, right? And identifying the difference between a cut on the large toe versus a major arterial bleed and then intervene, i.e. with potentially with tourniquets. How many of you have taught Stop the Bleed or instructors? Okay, fewer. I would encourage you all to become instructors. So contact your local regional level one. I'm sure they're doing it, and you can be educated on it. I also see some of our military folks in the crowd. So if you don't know who is teaching Stop the Bleed, I guarantee, because a lot of this came from the tactical medicine, if they're in your region, you know, they could help you too. So for many people, there's an interesting article that came out of L.A. So L.A., big urban area, almost all paid professional, highly trained EMS. 40% of them did not feel comfortable packing a wound or putting on a tourniquet before they started their Stop the Bleed program. So what do you think our basic volunteer people think? So this is a big responsibility, I think, for everybody. And a take-home from this should be, how do I get involved? How do I teach, right? So it's not only teaching Pawpaw and Mama who are out there, but also teaching the EMS providers in your state. How many of you know if your BLS people are even allowed to put on a tourniquet by your state EMS rules? So not everybody. So I would encourage you, go home and find out, have the rules been modified so that your BLS providers can do that? Because if not, you're going to have more preventable deaths from things like this. All right, so packs it, calls his wife, that's good. Patient's on the ground, awake, conversant, severe leg pain. Heart rate 125, blood pressure 80. There's this blood, shirt is soaked, there's blood all over the ground, big obvious soft tissue injury, and an open fracture. So what would you recommend that they do? Dr. Deutschman?
Well, they're usually, I recommend that they get control of the bleeding first. Our EMS have been trained to use the CAT tourniquets, and they've all had stop the bleed training in my community.
Wow, all?
Yeah. Well, all, 15.
Oh, like 15 of them? How about in your state? Do you know what the people in your state can do?
I don't, but I'm an ATLS instructor and course coordinator, and my understanding from the rest of the state, of which there are few of us teaching, is that it's they're reaching out and doing it. The EMS, I think, have all been trained in the bigger cities, but still not in the smaller communities.
Okay. And I would argue that it's more important in the smaller cities than the bigger cities, right? Because the time to definitive care is important. How about, let's go down the road. Next, how many of your EMS providers are trained and allowed?
In my town, I'm in a town of 17,000. We actually have a paid ambulance service in our town. We have some ALS providers on the rigs. They're trained in it. But around our community, around Rutland, is all rural small communities, which are all volunteer. And there is we don't have any dedicated sort of training protocol for that. And their ability, their training in providing tourniquets, using CAT tourniquets is, I would say, at best sporadic and individualized. Some of them have had their own training and some of them have had none, because many of them had a number of those individuals had previous military experience, so that helps.
Okay. Rick, how about in your state?
Our ambulances, the equipment list for ambulances in Iowa, part of eliminating masked trousers was...
Thank God, the agent of the devil.
...was putting in tourniquets. So tourniquets are required material for our ambulances in Iowa, and everyone, BLS, anyone who's on an ambulance knows how to use them.
Okay. Dr. Knight, do you know the status in West Virginia?
No, but one thing that we have really tried to do is engage with our EMS professionals and do train the trainer programs with them to really empower them to be leaders within the community to push these programs out into the school systems and community groups and those kind of things, and really bring them to a place of leadership and empowerment so that they can spread even beyond what the trauma center itself could do.
All right, and could we get the update? Hello, very nice AV man. Can we get this blue update thing to go away? All right, so sounds like it's from a variety of different standpoints as to who's trained. So hopefully they can recognize significant bleeding. Okay, that was simple. Thank you. Look, man, I can't even turn on my TV without my kids helping me, so, The first thing he said as soon as I walked up, he must have sensed it. There must be like this aura, because he was like, don't touch the computer. I was like, okay. All right, so direct pressure can help until if they don't know how to put a thing on. Do you take the dressing down and look at the wound at the site of the injury? Rick, you going to tell your EMS folks they should take the dressing down?
Here's the deal. This person's outcome is absolutely related to time to definitive care. Can we all agree on that?
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Anything that happens in the pre-hospital period needs to be focused on stop whatever exsanguinating hemorrhage is present, and then eliminate any additional delay to care. I don't care if they look or don't look. You know what? They're medics. Take a look. Whatever. But then put the tourniquet on properly and don't dink around after that. That's what I think.
Okay. So how many up here on the panel still have EMS crews that feel obligated to give the 2 liters of crystalloid? You still see that?
I'm lucky if they are able to establish access.
Okay. Sometimes that's actually better, right? How many of you in the crowd have EMS crews that still, whether fender bender or major trauma, feel obligated to give 2 liters of crystalloid when they first assess them, if it's an ALS crew. So some of that's still out there. Yep. So it's good to see that I think even in our rural areas, we're seeing less and less of giving a lot of crystalloid. And that's an important message for us to keep reiterating to our EMS community, because they look at the vitals, I think, and people get all angst about, well, they're hypotensive. But sometimes if all you have is crystalloid, that's better to leave it like that. He's mentating, he's alert, right? So, all right. So how many of your EMS crews up here, your advanced groups, have the ability to give blood on the scene? None? Okay. All right. How about out here? Anybody have EMS able to give blood? Okay.
Well, after the helicopter gets there.
Yeah, so if the helicopter comes and it's the AeroVac, then they can.
Well, and I think some of it is, it depends on the aircraft carrier, or the, mm-hmm. the EMS aircraft carrier. So some in West Virginia, we have a hospital-based aircraft system that does carry blood, and then there are other systems or other aircraft, air medical providers who are either in Pennsylvania or in Ohio, and not all of them carry blood products with them. So it I don't know that all air medical are equal.
They are not. I would agree with that. Everybody agree? All air medical is not equal?
Our air medical can give it, but they have to get it from the hospital. Mm-hmm. And we have the additional challenge that sometimes our trauma patients go to Montana and sometimes they go to Utah, and they're not allowed to give blood crossing state lines.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Didn't know that.
Right. So that's a way, that is something that we as the trauma community can try to work together across state lines within regional committee on traumas to try to advocate, to try to help, depending on where they are, right? Because it makes no sense to be dripping blood in and they're like, okay, crossing the line. You're like, oh, too bad for you, you know. Right. So, you know, that may be something that we can put into place. So, all right, how many still have folks that if they're shocky at all, people feel the need to intubate those patients? Folks seeing that?
Sometimes.
We see it all the time,
sometimes,
right?
Yeah.
So shock means intubate, and so continuing to reinforce why are they shocky. So, all right, so I think we've touched a fair amount on...
I want to bone a friend. Ooh. Quick.
Oh, boy.
We've got all these friends out here. Sorry, Allison. I want to know, all of you, who in your pre-hospital area would this patient get TXA?
That's the next slide.
Okay. Yeah, okay, so I'm phoning a friend. I know.
We're getting to that point.
I want to know if I'm on their side or not.
So the other thing I would other thing I would encourage you to do is you're going to see more and more literature. There's a big debate about should aeromedical be carrying blood or be carrying FFP. And I would encourage you to read those articles very, 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 very closely. I would encourage you to look at the data, not just the abstract, because there's a school of thought that they shouldn't need to carry it, but I don't know that they're breaking out some of the pre-hospital times and how those patients are getting there. I think there's a distinct difference to being 30 minutes away from a level one trauma center and definitive care from the scene, and being 4 hours away and having to go by, you know, some other thing or stop or whatnot. So be cautious and be careful just reading some of the literature that's coming out, that even if they're multidisciplinary, multi-center, see if they break out things by pre-hospital time or time to definitive care. And if not, I would be careful generalizing that data to your situation. So, all right. So, TXA.
Wow. I set you up perfectly.
You did, and it's amazing. Honestly, he did not see these slides ahead of time. I did not send them to any of them. So, TXA. Should it be used? Should it not? Should it be pre-hospital or hospital? Who's using it? Should there be some sort of delineation about what your resources are? There is a retrospective study that just came out, I believe, in J Trauma, I think just last month, that said that TXA had no impact on mortality. This was a civilian trauma center study. that, you know, was a well-designed study. But again, it is not just rural. It's not a rural center. So let's go down the line. Using TXA in your area or EMS? Susan?
We have it. I don't know how much they're using it. You would know better because they're going to give it on the helicopter. Like, they're not stopping at our place. So.
Okay, so yeah. You don't
but
see...
I know we have it in our building.
Do they show up to you? What if Mama brings, drives them in the tractor?
I haven't seen that.
You haven't given it. Okay, Rick?
We'll come back to my thoughts on it. If you're in Iowa, some of the jurisdictions use it and have protocols. Some don't. At our end, at the receiving end, all I really want to know is if you gave it or didn't give it, because that has implications then for us. I'm interested what y'all have to hear, and then I've got my own opinions.
Okay. Dr. Deutschman?
We have it. EMS does not. Okay. We have it in our formulary and our pharmacy, but we have yet to develop any sort of protocol where to give guidance to our primary ER provider. Okay. To know when to give it or not.
Okay.
So not in a pre-hospital setting. We have it in the ER. We don't have it on protocol. It's discretionary. We do use it for exsanguinating hemorrhage.
Okay. Dr. Knight?
I think one of the air medical providers that's in our area can administer it pre-hospital, and I think that it's a point of discussion with our local EMS. There are some of the smaller emergency rooms in West Virginia that do give it. And do have it, and I think the biggest challenge and is that, you know, the reality is in a rural setting. I think if it's going to be given, it's kind of a either in the field or at the smaller hospitals, because by the time you get to our center, it's oftentimes too late beyond the scope of the window that's available there in that first 4 hours of trauma for us to be able to give it. Oftentimes,
yeah. So the window being 3 hours from time of injury, right? So. That's really where, if you're going to use it, that's when you have to use it. So if by the time they get to a level one, if you're more than that, you're not using it. So how many of you who said you are at a level one or level two in a more resource-rich environment have thromboelastography? Some, yes. So are you using, if you see hyperfibrinolysis, how many of you are using TXA or Amicar if they're outside the window to fix hyperfibrinolysis? Some. Okay. All right.
So I think, so that's getting at the crux of it. And this is where my personal bias comes in. That's really getting at the crux of it, is ideally we can use this based on something objective, thromboelastography, Rotem at our place, whatever. That is not helpful in the pre-hospital period because you don't have that. And so in the pre-hospital, you have to make your best guess about who's going to be most likely to be hyperfibrinolytic. And hopefully, and we've got smart people sitting right in front of me, and I'm feeling like bad because they're the smart people who are figuring this out. Hopefully we're going to actually get some evidence-based stuff on it. The advice that I give our places when the medical directors are asking, should we incorporate TXA into our pre-hospital protocols? The advice I give is let's try to pick the people who are most likely to need blood when they get to the emergency room. Because if they're getting blood in our emergency room, then we're going on the massive transfusion at our place. Right now, we are using TXA until we have some guidance from the Rotem. And so penetrating injury with shock, especially if it's a young person, penetrating injury with shock, that's the best advice that I'm giving people. All comers, no. I'm trying to tell them no for just the generic all-comer injured people.
And what's the concern with all comers?
Well, so the concern with all comers is that you can make things worse. Whether you believe, whether this fibrinolysis. So the idea is that some people who have coagulopathy with trauma, some people are hyperfibrinolytic and are coagulopathic. Other people are hypercoagulable. And TXA, though it's cheap and easy, it may make thrombotic problems worse. So we can't just say that it's a completely benign drug without any side effects. So now we have to try to sort out who are the people who are most likely to be fibrinolytic. That's my simple way of thinking about it.
Well, so I think you're spot on, right? And everyone's correct. If you're going to give it, you got to give it within 3 hours. And probably all comers is, I think we definitely don't think that that's the answer. But in those who are getting or at risk for a massive transfusion, it very well may be helpful. Hyperfibrinolysis is bad. It helps with hyperfibrinolysis. Mm-hmm. It may cause fibrinolytic shutdown, which then increases your complications later, right? But in a place if you can't tell which it is, I think your highest risk patients, we would agree, are those getting a massive transfusion, right? Or those hypotensive in class 4 shock from bleeding. Would you agree with that, Rick?
In general. Now, we're going back to this case, and I'm kind of on the fence. This case, isolated, bleeding popliteal area, bleeding controlled with tourniquet. I'm kind of on the fence, and in general, that person probably, I wouldn't be recommending TXA, but I wish, I'll look forward to whatever data we actually get from it.
Yeah.
Do you skew any of that if you're based in a resource-limited environment? So in my world, we have skiers, we have mountain bikers, we have farmers. They come in, I won't say penetrating trauma, let's say open fractures. They come in with massive blunt injuries, bellies full of blood, extremities that are soaked, hypotensive. For us, a massive transfusion protocol is 3 units of blood. So,
I love it.
That's
the real world.
We're heading towards maxing out blood bank pretty quick. So at that point, then, would you favor TXA at that point? Because frankly, in that environment, we would.
So, sure, that one I can go with. That the person who's truly hemorrhagic shock is probably falling into the category where they're most likely to be coagulopathic, meaning bleeding coagulopathic. So I think that's a good example.
Yeah, and that's sort of a similar environment that we have is that we don't give our 2 liters up front, but when we run out of blood, that's all we have left to give.
Right. And if it's bad weather, and you know, like where I am, you're talking about 15 minutes in the helicopter to get to Allison, or you're talking about an hour and a half if the roads are snowy and the helicopter can't fly. So it can be day to day very different.
That's right. So I think the message here is that there's still a lot of things coming out about TXA. Again, when the papers are coming out, read the entire paper, not just the abstract, because you're going to see some things that are saying, you know, TXA, just get rid of it, don't do it anymore. But I think for those who, you know, you have 4 units or less of blood, you only have so much, we know crystalloid is going to make it worse. You're going to increase your compartment syndrome, you're going to increase your lung injury, your renal failure and things if you give 10 liters of crystalloid. So it's not as black and white, I think, in the resource-limited environments as it is for some of the urban centers. And again, it's that access to definitive care. So just getting to you isn't often definitive care, although there may be some things that you can do. So how many of you work in an environment where you have less than 10 units of PRBCs? Yeah, a fair amount, right? And you can blow through those pretty quick if you have somebody with a pelvis fracture or, you know, a belly and a pelvis and things pretty quickly. So I guess the question is, you know, until we definitively know one way or another, you're going to have to develop local protocols to figure out who it is you're going to use this on. And in our practice and in our state, what we say is if you're in class 3 or 4 shock and you're not at a level 1 or level 2 center where they can provide definitive care, then if you present in shock and we're starting blood, we recommend giving it. So not everybody who's in a trauma accident, but in that subset. Now, can I base that with class 1 data? Absolutely not. This is one of those, we sit around in our state trauma system, and it's one of those, you know, la 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 la, pull it out of your butt and say, this is the best we got right now, and we're going to go for it, right? So, and then you keep looking critically at the information. So I think there's a lot out about this, but again, read the entire paper and look at the patients that are being studied. Don't, you know, don't just read the abstract or the headline and make your decisions for your region based on this. All right, so tourniquet placed, I think tips we've talked about. Pitfalls, Dr. Knight, pitfalls of tourniquet placement.
You know, I think that a couple pitfalls are you really want a commercially available tourniquet, a shoestring, a belt. Those kinds of things really don't provide the appropriate level of pressure. You want to put the tourniquet as low down on the extremity as possible because you want to, if you are going to have a long period of time when the tourniquet might be on, you want to save as much of the perfusion to that leg. And in this case, if it's a popliteal injury, if you can get away with like just above the knee in order to not risk damaging the muscle more proximally. And then the tourniquet really should be as tight as you need for the bleeding to stop. I think talking to the patient and letting the patient know that this is going to be not just uncomfortable, but very painful for that patient. If a tourniquet, I think, is placed appropriately to stop the arterial bleeding, it's going to be very painful, the tourniquet itself, and then over time, the leg itself is going to become more painful. Being prepared to not release it and stick with that plan until the patient can get the definitive care, I think, is important.
Rick, can you make the bleeding worse with a tourniquet?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And what is that?
Absolutely make the bleeding worse. My favorite, well, it's like my least favorite, actually, report to get is from EMS is tourniquet was applied at whatever time, and pulses have been good after that. Yeah. completely concur about the improvised tourniquets and tourniquets not being properly applied, meaning not being put on tight enough to stop arterial bleeding. Those are the pitfalls.
I think it's also key to know the time. Writing the time down is key. For us, transport for the field can be quick. It can be 2 hours to get to us, and then we're 2 hours to the next level to get to a level one trauma center. So, you know, and then you're 4 hours at that point. So
your risk of limb loss and neuropraxia and nerve damage and irreversible muscle damage, if the tourniquet's on less than 2 hours, is pretty low risk. You start getting above that, it starts to go up gradually. But remember, when you teach people how to use tourniquets, you've got to teach them that the distal pulse must be absent. If you just put the tourniquet on and you occlude the venous outflow, but they still have inflow, then all you'll do is they'll keep pumping blood in the extremity and then it'll just come right out your wound. Right, so they have to occlude the distal pulse or else it's not on appropriately. And one thing you have to encourage them to do is reassess, right? Because you put it on and your distal pulse is gone. Now they get a unit of blood or now they somewhat auto-resuscitate because they're not bleeding anymore, at least originally. Their blood pressure comes up a little bit. Now 10, 15 minutes later, you're in the back of the ambulance and now their blood pressure's higher and now they do have a distal pulse or now they're starting to bleed through. So you have to constantly check and recheck. So recommendations are leave the tourniquet visible so you can be sure it doesn't come off. And then also be sure that you reassess and make sure that the distal pulses remain gone.
And what
absent.
About change it? So when they show up with the belt that the fireman put on and it's working, do you switch it for a approved one?
Or you put another one on.
Put two on?
Yeah. And if one doesn't work, you put a second one on, right? Yep. That's the general recommendations. Now, for those of you, many of you are from rural states where you have a lot of various people, various training and personnel, and there's more and more training going on with police, EMS, FBI, as well as our military colleagues, where they're teaching tactical care. So here may be a little bit of a difference between those folks and you just have to talk this out. Care under fire, you're going to put it on high and tight, right? Because they got to shoot back, right? So that may be one thing that's different. For us in civilians, you're not in a threatened environment. You don't have to put it all the way up in the groin. But you're going to do that if you don't know where all the wounds are, right? So something to talk about, something to think about, and you may have some issues. So where should they go, Dr. Deutschman? Or Dr. Conway, where should they go? You've got your level ones. Let's say it's in your environment, so it's 2 hours to the level one and 15 minutes to you. What would you hope that this EMS crew does?
So I can tell you in our neck of the woods, they'll come to us.
Okay. All right.
If the only exception, we have one of the tertiaries has a helicopter which can fly some of the time. It rarely goes to the scene, so most of the time what we can hope for is the weather be good enough that they can come to us. In that instance, then that patient would come to us, and then we would, if we were not managing that patient, we were arranging for transport, we would, while the patient's coming to us, when we first knew about the patient, would be asking to see, can the helicopter fly? Can they meet us? We would assess them and then basically have them move on.
So activating and starting to initiate transfer from the time you either see the person or hear about the person, yeah? How many of you can start to the transfer process? If you're at a more resource-limited environment, how many of you, is it okay to start the transfer process before you even lay eyes on the patient? Any of you able to do that? Great. Good for you. Good for you. If not, I would recommend you work with those accepting places and see if you can start to do that. How many of you that are at a level one or level two empower folks to either EMS or the local hospital to start the transfer process before laying eyes on them? Accepted practice? Okay. So I would challenge you, those of you who are at a more resource-rich environment, if you know that it's going to exceed their level of care, start getting those resources together and empower them to do that, because it does take some administrative and logistical work, but it can take, from the time they see them, then they're very, very busy, that time ticks away pretty quick. And so if you can shave an hour off that time and start getting those resources lined up, particularly if there's a paucity of EMS or there's not the ability to fly and you know it's going to be a two-hour ground time and maybe somebody has to come from another county to get them, you can definitely shave off an hour or two from the time till they get to you and make a difference for this patient. So I think we all agree this would be a full trauma team activation, right? So you as surgeons would come in. I think we all agree class 4 shock, tourniquets in place. They've gotten no fluid and no blood. It's isolated to the lower extremity. There's no other signs of trauma. I'll just give that to you. In this patient, there's no trick. There's no other additional trauma. So what would you do while you're in the ED, Dr. Conway?
I was just asking Adam that.
He wasn't asking me what to do.
No. That too. As a matter of fact. So we're up blood first, because we would ask for that. In our meager resources, our master transfusion protocol is what it is. TXA. I would actually explore the wound. So I actually probably would take the tourniquet down with the idea I'd be putting it back up, but I would explore that because I'd want to see where the bleeding's coming from, get a sense of, is it arterial, is it venous, because you can't always tell. We have some vascular capability, so sort of there are some things that we will tackle ourselves. We've placed a shunt once with a train accident. So I would do that. If it was something beyond our capacity, then the tourniquet would go back up again a new time. And hopefully by then we'd have some transport capabilities. Okay. And resuscitation in place.
Dr. Deutschman, what would you all do?
As I mentioned before, we don't always have IV access when the patient gets to us. So we would establish good access. We would have an issue. We have a hot button in our ER, so if we push that button, the helicopter just starts coming. They don't even need to know what destination they're going to go to, but they will come, and they have sometimes come and just waited until the patient was able to go or they died. They'll happily wait around and just be available to us.
That's really nice.
We would give blood. We would make sure that other elements were taken care of. As Dr. Conway said, we would also look at the wound. We have some vascular capability. I've got a couple of things on the shelf that I could use in a pinch.
Okay. Dr. Long?
Well, pretty much the same as Dr. Deutschman. We don't have any vascular capability, really, but in a pinch, I would probably look just to see what was going on, but then put the tourniquet back up. We can start blood and splint the legs so that it's not flopping all around and get the helicopter there as quick as possible. Okay. That's about what we can do.
Dr. Sidwell and Dr. Knight, the only question I have for you, not to exceed the answer to this question, is how many of you are also in this patient who's been in class 4 shock now for about 30 minutes, would also start FFP early and frontline in combination with your blood? Go ahead.
Yes. I think if you have those resources for this patient, given the degree of shock, I think the expectation is that you're going to have a large volume resuscitation. And so starting a matched resuscitation with blood products, I think, is important. It wasn't mentioned earlier, but making sure this patient has a tetanus shot and some antibiotics, I think, is also really important.
Yes, of course we do. The problem is getting the FFP at our place. I mean, we don't have it ready, so by the time it's thawed, hopefully the patient's out the door.
We recently got a rapid thawing device, but those four go quickly. Mm.
So that's the other. So we can say do a matched response, right? But matched response will rapidly go away if you're in one of these hospitals that has 10 of red cells and 2 of FFP, and then you're unmatched very, very quickly. So there is data emerging that giving the FFP, and if you have it, platelets early on in these patients who you know are bleeding and you know have been in class 4 shock, so you know it's about 50% of their blood volume, giving that earlier rather than waiting. There are some things to keep your eyes open for. There's some freeze-dried plasma that seems to be coming down the pike. There's some lyophilized plasma that's coming down the pike. So there's been use in stuff like this in Europe for about 10 years. It's not yet FDA approved. Dr. Martin and you all may be able to correct me, but my understanding is there's a product probably within the year that will be FDA approved. Yeah, so that would have a long shelf life and does not require thawing, and it's like a powder or whatnot, and you can mix it and give it. So keep your eyes open. Of course, there'll be a cost to that, and everyone will moan and groan, but we know that they stop bleeding sooner and that it's a good thing to give your FFP and platelets if you have it up front in these class 4 patients' shock. So, all right, so they get a film. I don't know if you can see it, but there's a pretty severe tibial plateau that's there as well. They get the red cells. They let the tourniquet down. And da-da-da-da. So now the profound hypotension to the point where now the patient is unresponsive not talking, not mentating. So more blood, more access, tourniquet back up. So let's just talk just briefly for a minute or two. So many of you said you take the tourniquet down. Do you wait till you have access to do that? Do you do that in your ED? Do you do that in an operating room? Dr. Long, where would you do that?
Well, I would probably look at the wound, but I probably wouldn't take the tourniquet down.
Okay, so a no tourniquet down. Story change now. No more tourniquet down. All right.
I would look. But
take the tourniquet down. You did the right thing. It's probably, and I don't know the number, but I'll bet it's 3 out of 5 who come in with a tourniquet on that's applied pre-hospital, they don't have a bad arterial bleed. And it's something that, as surgeons, all of us in the room can readdress. It'll be a venous bleed or be something that doesn't need anything, or they're bleeding from the fracture and not really from an arterial injury. And so we're all surgeons. Take the tourniquet down, look at the wound. They're not going to die right in front of you. Put the tourniquet back up if it's really bleeding.
Are you going to do that as soon as they hit the door, or are you going to wait till you have blood in the room?
They're not. They've got to turn it on quick. Look at them over. Don't get all distracted, because remember the basic people, they saw this blood and they had a T-shirt on. They put a tourniquet on.
Right.
Do all your stuff. Make sure there's not any other bad wound. Get everyone in the room settled down and make sure you've got your IV access. And then when everyone's like calmed down, then just take the tourniquet down and look, and it'll either be bleeding, and if it's bleeding, put the tourniquet back up and then figure out what your plan's going to be. Or it's not bleeding, then just put a bandage on it and splint it, and you're fine. But look at the wound.
The first thing that should happen is what you would do with
with ATLS anyway. I mean, the patient comes in, you're going
to
establish access, you're going to do your ABCs.
It's going to depend on whether the helicopter's
there. We wouldn't
there.
Do other than that.
So I'm assuming we did all that. That's why I gave you that there was no injury, no other injury anyplace else, right? Because we've already spent a fair amount of time just getting to this point. Can you imagine if we went through all that? So work with me, kind of follow my lead. It's kind of like dancing, right? So, but I guess the question is, prepare the room. And we all are surgeons, yes, and so you know the anatomy. A deep wound to the popliteal fossa, where you have exposed bone, is more likely to have a popliteal injury than a laceration in the lateral aspect of the anterior compartment of the shin, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you, as a surgeon, need to temper that. A large wound in the groin that comes right under the infrarenal, and you can put your hand in all the way down to the femur bone, that's a different wound than, you know, a cut over the knee, right? Yep. So I agree, and I think everybody would agree, you know, examine the wound, and then I think you're really going to temper based on, you know, where the wound is and the anatomy, and knowing the anatomy and knowing what the physiology has been to see. Certainly, I think we've all seen, you know, in lacerations to the toe, which did involve, you know, an artery, but it was a digital artery, right? That a tourniquet really isn't necessary. But at the same time, you know, thinking about what's going to be next, and it's that anticipation of what could happen that you want to be aware of. Dr. Conway, did you have something you wanted to add to that? I think I cut you off.
When you first take the tourniquet down, I mean, if somebody comes in with direct pressure, somebody comes in with a tourniquet on, I had a lad who stabbed himself in the femoral artery, right in the groin once, and he was 30 minutes getting to us with an EMS provider basically sitting on his groin. I examined that as soon as they came in. They stopped holding pressure. You examined it. It wasn't like immediately it was... It started oozing. There's a sort of a pseudo clot there. You start pulling the dressing out. Then you're mucking around a little bit. Suddenly, then you see, oh, look, there's lots of blood. Then, you know, everybody, all hands on board, you're putting pressure back on. But the issue for us is I would never do that. And I don't think, I hope, would assume none of us would have the wherewithal to do that in an instance where you at least didn't have the capacity to, you know, reinfuse fluids or blood. Because otherwise you're just setting yourself up for failure.
So set up your room, get your blood in the room if it looks like it's a high-risk area, and have your people ready, make sure you have access, have your blood ready to go if you're gonna do that, I think.
I think just one thing for me and Adam, being in places where we have to sort of make a decision about transport, and it can be so different, is that, like, there are times when, you know, if the poop is hitting the fan and there's nobody coming, you're going to do something different than if the helicopter's
Absolutely.
5 minutes away.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, would I get out a clamp and clamp something and get my hand on it, you know, which I would never do if the helicopter was on its way. But if it was 3 feet of snow and nobody's coming, you know, that's a whole different story. So I think that it's a little different for us than for Matt. He has a lot more resources where he is. But
I would also say that one of the other things that we probably would have done where I am is knowing, if we knew that this guy was coming in, we probably would have had our small OR crew present and our anesthetist present.
Aha. It's almost like you read the next slide.
Oh,
well, anytime we have a trauma one, everybody comes at our place.
So they already come.
So
your OR comes in for any level one?
Any level one ours comes.
We do not have it protocolized, but we have it in practice.
Yeah. So that may be a good take-home message, too. If you're at a rural, remote area where it may take a while for your full trauma team activations, can you work out that, you know, when that activation goes off, that notifies the OR and anesthesia as well? Because it can be a challenge. Now you've made the decision to go to the operating room. Now you got to make the calls, and now you got to give them their 30 minutes to come in, and that can be a challenge. Dr. Conway, how about in your environment?
So we don't have a trauma activation.
Okay.
It's individual. So if I'm coming in and it's for something like this, they're calling me in for a trauma like this, then I call the OR team in, especially if I think there's some capacity that I'm going to need to help. I've done that in the past. Frankly, we supposedly have a 30-minute response time, but I can tell you after 11 o'clock at night, the 30-minute response time, unless I'm doing most of the wheeling patients here and there and grabbing things myself and opening the table and opening the instruments, which I've done multiple times, is more like an hour.
Mm-hmm. That's the time-expanded environment as opposed to the time-compressed environment, right? All right, so you get to the OR. You have a deep laceration. Popliteal artery and vein are transected. You've taken them up to the operating room. You know, what do you do? You're going to try to do a definitive repair, vein versus graft, or what else can you do? This is for Dr. Long, Deutschman, or Conway.
Given the details that you have so clearly defined for us.
Here's the artery. Here, and here, yeah. Right? That's mucho bado.
Yeah,
that's
so,
the official
yeah.
Spanish translation of that,
so,
right?
So given his pre-hospital and ER course, I would not attempt a definitive repair at that time.
Okay.
I think trying to shunt and make sure his bones aren't moving, get him out of there, hopefully go from OR to helicopter would be really ideal.
Right. So is that a challenge for you? If once you take them to the operating room and they are now an inpatient, does that make it more of a challenge to transfer?
No.
No. Anybody that's a problem once you bring them in the operating room? Yeah. So that's something that I would recommend. Reach out to your level ones and reach out to those trauma medical directors, because that should be solvable, right? So there's always this inpatient, outpatient. Once they're an inpatient, if the level one's full, then they go on the inpatient wait list. You can change that, right? But you got to have your trauma medical directors at your level one be able to do that. So it is feasible. There's no law against it. You should be able to transfer from the operating room to another institution's operating room or ICU, right? And you can make that a priority. But it does require agreements and work and all that stuff. But that's an administrative thing. So don't let the tail wag the dog. All right. So shunts. Let's talk about that. So they decide to do a shunt. So Dr. Knight, if you've done shunts before, what do you recommend that they use for a shunt?
There are commercially available shunts that if you have. If you don't, you can use just about any material to span the gap. You want to do something that's, you know, size appropriate. You don't want something too big or too small. But, you know, you could use IV tubing, or you could use a bread rubber catheter. I mean, there are lots of things that you could use if you had to. I think the concern you have here is whether or not you heparinize the patient. And I think you need to make that on probably a case-by-case basis. If this is the only injury that the patient has, I don't know that heparinization is a bad idea. I think the key at this point in time is to make sure that there's good communication with where the patient's going next, so that they know exactly what you did with regards to heparinization or with regards to your shunt.
Rick, how about from you? So technical tips on shunts?
No, I completely agree with all that. If you're in a bigger vessel, suction tubing, that's what I've used with iliac vein stuff. Long enough that you get purchase on each end, so long enough that you've got a couple of centimeters each side, but don't let it be bowing in the middle, so make sure that it's straight across. If you don't get it pushed all the way up in, then it'll be bowing, and that creates tension on each end. Don't worry about trimming the vessels. Just leave the end of the vessels ragged. Just secure it in place with a tie on each end. If there's any concern about movement, securing the shunt down to the surrounding tissue, so just a tie around the shunt to the tissue so that it doesn't move. Those are the technical things I think of.
Heparinize?
I wouldn't worry about heparinize.
Yeah. So there is good data that you do not need to heparinize these. And they can actually stay in place there have been documentations of up to 48, and I even know of a case where it was 72 hours without heparin in a larger vessel. So popliteal, brachial, or bigger, not small. If it's small, then that's not going to work. But there are situations, at least in femoral, of 72 hours. I do know of popliteals up to 48. No heparin, so you don't need to. So you want the biggest conduit that you can find that's going to fit inside that vessel. The tip not to breed the vessel is important. Use the ragged edge, just make sure it's in. You want to ensure that you've got proximal and distal about 2 centimeters in, so you have some wiggle room. A tip I would give is take whatever you're going to use, find the middle of it, tie a suture right in the middle, and that way you know where the middle of the shunt is. So if it starts to move or something moves around, that you know exactly where the middle of the shunt was, and then make sure you document that and tell it to whoever you're handing off to. Once you get it in, and if you can, a Fogarty to pull out any thrombi distally to ensure you have flow is good. If you don't, do your best. And then put it in proximally, make sure you have flow, thrombectomize the distal end, make sure you have flow, and then feed it in. And then one thing I was taught was you take your sutures on the vessel, right, about within a centimeter of the edge of the vessel, tie it around good and tight. It will crush that, but that's going to get debrided off at the definitive care anyway. So you don't want it 2-3 centimeters out to hold it, because then you have to resect all of that. So keep it close to the edge. And then a trick I was taught was then don't cut those sutures. Keep it tied at the end. So you're going to put one. You got your suture in the middle. It's just marking. You got your suture here, a suture here, and then tie those together. So you're not pulling, it's not pulling back and forth. Now, that's a personal bias, but, you know, just a way to do it. So you just want to make sure you know where it is. Cross it. Yep. It's harder. Yeah. Yep. And you may need to do the same a little bit with the vessel to open the vessel, because you will have spasm for sure. Mm-hmm. But yes, that's a good tip, is to cut the tubing at a bit of an angle so that it will feed in very nicely.
Yeah, and to watch out for an intimal, lifting the intima, because mm-hmm. you
right.
create a dissection.
Don't shish kebab. Yeah. Right, so don't make it too long. Tie clove hitch. And this is probably the only pop. I tell you, if we go to Emory or to Houston, well, Houston may know, but you go to Emory or Penn and say you got to tie a clove hitch, my guess is they'll be confused. But this group probably knows what that is. So, yeah. All right. So shunt's done. You ligated the vein. We're going to move along now. You know there's going to be a long ischemia time. So what are you going to do? What else are you going to do?
Do a two incision, four compartment.
Fasciotomy.
Fasciotomy.
Yeah. Yeah. So again, the fasciotomy, you know, who, when, where. So I think this patient, long pre-hospital ischemia time. You've now got flow back. They're probably going to have a reperfusion issue. This may be the one you do a prophylactic fasciotomy on. I know that's very controversial in the vascular literature, but that's important. Any good general surgeon can learn how to do this or relearn, because I'm sure many of you learned in your residency. Which compartment most often gets missed? Dr. Knight?
The deep posterior.
Yeah. So make sure you get all the compartments open. Okay. So this is a great thing for both learning to do these shunts as well as doing your fasciotomies. Finding a center that teaches ASET is one good thing. And then work with that coordinator and say, hey, you know, not only could we do the standard vascular approaches, but could we also practice some shunts and then practice and redo some fasciotomies, or work with your level one if they have a cadaver lab available and see if you can do that. It's a nice way to kind of get your hands rewarmed if you haven't done this in a while. So
we also occasionally offer that at the Advanced Rural Surgical Skills course.
That sounds great, the Advanced Surgical Skills course. So, all right, so they get to the level one, legs perfused, the compartment's open, muscles viable. When do you take them back, Dr. Sidwell?
This person will probably just go right away. We'll make sure that all their hemodynamics are okay and their clotting, and go back right away and take a look at what's there and come up with the plan for putting a graft in.
All right, Dr. Knight, do you stabilize the bone first, the vascular first? Who does the vascular repair, and what about soft tissue coverage?
At our institution, vascular surgery would probably do the vascular repair. I think the big question is fixing the bone and making sure that you're not having a length discrepancy. So I think that this is where communication and good communication between the orthopedic team and the vascular team, so that the bone can be addressed and the arterial supply be reestablished, but keeping in mind that you want to make sure that there's not any tension placed on the repair. I think if the trauma team needs to be involved in order to help those collegial communications happen, that's certainly an option. And at our institution, we have it set up now where the vascular and cardiac operations are done in a different tower in a different operating room area. And we've had to really work to figure out which trauma patients are taken care of in our trauma-designated OR, which is kind of in our main operating room area, and then what patients are appropriate to go into the Heart and Vascular Institute operating room area where they don't have any of the orthopedic equipment, but in our main ORs, they don't have all of the bells and whistles that the vascular surgeons now require in order to do the vascular repair. And so this has taken a great deal of communication between the two in order to figure out which patients are appropriate for vascular to come into their uncomfortable environment or for orthopedics to go into their uncomfortable environment in order to make sure the best care is administered to the patient.
And just to try to, so we can get to the next couple of cases, soft tissue coverage, we do know that long-term outcome is better if they can get soft tissue coverage, i.e. flap coverage, within 7 days of time of injury.
And we track that as part of our PI process.
So, and then if you are at a place and they have younger vascular surgeons, and this is the popliteal, and you've got a shunt in, and they're saying they're going to do this endovascularly, I would recommend you go and show up in the operating room and help enlighten them, because we're seeing more and more of that, right? So vein, if it's going to be distal vessel, is still superior to the synthetics as well. So lessons learned, stop the bleeding ASAP, reestablish flow ASAP, know about tourniquet times, ischemia time, and you don't have to be a vascular surgeon. Every single one of you in this audience, if you're a surgeon and surgically trained, can do shunts. If you haven't done them or done them in a while, go relearn how to do it because you'll save a life and save a limb. All right, case two, 25-year-old male, snowboarding, crashed, hits a rock, no LOC, awake alert, chest wall and shoulder pain, blood pressure, a little tacky, blood pressure's a little low, and he picks you up and he goes to the local hospital. Dr. Long, what are you going to worry about in this kid? We're going to assume you do your A, B, C, Ds, those are the vitals, those are his complaints. What do you worry about?
Lung injury.
Okay.
Spleen.
Anything else?
Spleen,
okay.
Right.
All right, so aorta maybe, yep. So level of activation, I think in many places this would be a partial trauma team activation if you have it. Awake and alert, no neck pain. Left upper quadrant pain, I'm going to give you. Pelvis is stable and there's no long bone deformities. So again, I think we're thinking pulmonary, ribs, spleen maybe, right? That's going to be your problem. All right, so chest x-ray, here it is. Dr. Knight, what do you see?
I see what looks like probably a left-sided hemothorax, given the haziness on that side. There's some displaced rib fractures that I can appreciate.
Yep.
I don't see any subcutaneous there. It's difficult to see if there's a pneumo from here, but definitely the haziness on that side more than the right side with the rib fractures that look pretty significant.
All right. We're going to go with no pneumo, very little hemothorax. You're not really worried about it. Let's work through this. So let's say, Dr. Deutschman, they're there, you're in the ED, they've got a positive FAST, but no hypotension. What would you do?
With all the other items that you stated, I would go ahead and put them through the CAT scanner.
Okay, CT scan. Let's take a vote. No hypotension, positive FAST, scan? Okay. All right, good. How about negative FAST, but positive hypotension. Dr. Conway.
Yeah, we've seen this. So all the basic things, good IV access, negative FAST. I would try a trial of some IV fluids. I'd try and see whether the patient responded because a lot of times they receive pain medication maybe by somebody maybe they shouldn't have or too quickly, in which case then you see a little drop in blood pressure. You have to determine whether it's significant. I'd still CAT scan them.
That person's getting scanned in my place,
okay.
For sure.
So would you give blood before you take them to the scanner if they are still hypotensive after initial fluid challenge?
Did I do the FAST or did somebody else do the FAST?
You did the FAST.
Then I wouldn't.
Okay. Anybody else? Hypotensive patient, 25-year-old, trauma, blood before you take them to the scanner or while you're in the scanner, with a negative fast but hypotension after trauma.
You said that he moves his arms and his legs?
Moves everything. Okay. There is no spinal cord injury here.
See, we can get them in the scanner way faster than we can get the blood. We're taking him to the scanner and the blood's coming. Yeah, because the scanner's like 10 feet away.
I'd be talking to my folks about getting the blood. I think that, you know, there's a different kind of damage control treatment that we do at our facility, and that is what's the worst thing that can happen if we're wrong about thinking about things.
So. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, he can croak in the scanner. That's kind of bad. All right, Rick, what would you advise? You're out doing a rural trauma team course. They ask you about this case that they had a few months ago. How would you advise them? They can get to a scanner really quick. His blood pressure's 80 over 50. His heart rate's, 120. He's got chest wall pain, belly pain.
I've got lots of
fast is negative.
Okay, lots and 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 lots of thoughts here. Number one, we're all here in this room because we're surgeons, and so by definition, we work at a hospital that's surgical capability. That completely changes my opinion. So the presence or absence of surgical capability completely changes my opinion about how this should be handled. Jump to just the routine level 4 hospital where there's not surgical capability. Okay. Number one, I don't even recommend for them that they used fast. This is a departure from what ATLS teaches, because if the person's in shock, they don't have anything they can do with a positive fast anyway, and we need to be mobilizing that person, not to mention the practical aspects of acquiring and maintaining skill. But we're all at a place right now, we're at a level 3 hospital because we're all surgeons. Positive fast, but no hypotension. That was just a practice exam to go do your scan. Negative fast, but hypotension. You check through your checklist quick to make sure there's not another bleeding source. So you got to check chest x-ray, you got to see what his pelvis is like. And then repeat your fast. Mm-hmm. And that's deciding, am I going to the operating room or am I not going to the operating room? Still have a negative fast, still have hypotension. I think the most likely thing is that your fast is a false negative. And you're someplace where there's surgical capability. Sure, start the blood. Scan them. That's fine. It's not going to delay you all that much. Knowing that if that scan is positive and the person is shocky, you know what? You're committed to taking that spleen out before transferring them because we're surgeons.
So I think some of the take-home things are, if your initial fast is negative, think about how quickly did they get to you from the scene, because you may not see a lot of blood, and 10 minutes later there may be a lot of blood. So never feel bad about repeating your fast exam. Okay, there are some people who say you can keep them on the backboard and tip them right side down. That's a very sensitive view, and that way you may get some blood that pools over there and you may see it a little more sensitively. I don't know that that's a word. So if you're going to take them to the scanner, I would strongly recommend you be able to act on that, and I'd strongly recommend that you take some blood with you. So have the blood bank meet you there. I hear it when you say we can't get the blood or it will take longer, but take the blood or have them meet you with you, because they're bleeding, 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 bleeding. You've already ruled out tension pneumo. You've ruled out those other obstructive issues. 25-year-old hypotensive after trauma. Assume they're bleeding until they prove to you that they're not.
We've also seen renal injuries with these mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. Yep, but they still need blood.
Oh, absolutely, right. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. But in our place, like literally you walk out the ER door and the scanner's right there and the lab's right here. So the lab people will be coming and the whole trauma team will follow.
I get it. I'm just telling you, as an ACS reviewer, when I go to small places and I go to level 3s and I see they code it in the scanner, then that, you know, like the little horn starts to grow.
Yeah.
So I recognize you got to mobilize those, but get the blood with you. They are bleeding, bleeding, bleeding from somewhere. Whether it's kidney, retroperitoneum, spleen, or whatnot, until proven otherwise. Yes, sir. Brief comment.
I think the basic principle that we always teach is that whether you're in a big level 1 trauma center or in a any other hospital. If you're hypotensive, you should not be in the CT scan.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think the answer to we have seen false negative fast, and the answer to that is really do a DPL. Don't let that patient out of your sight. And do DPL in the ED, and that's, I'll take him to the OR and do DPL there before you slash him wide open.
Yeah.
And if it's positive, you're in there, you go for it. And if it's negative, then you look for something else.
I hear a rumbling, but I 100%. A lot of people don't remember how to do a DPL. People are going to say that, oh, don't do that. I'm going to tell you, if you feel comfortable doing it, that's another way to help. You've just got to go through your problem list and figure out where the bleeding is, right? And so we're going to go on. This is the scan. It shows a grade 3 bleed, not a lot of hemoperitoneum. We're going to go back. He was not as hypotensive. So let's say never had any hypotension. So no hypotension. So he grade 3 spleen. Do you keep him at your center? So change the scenario. Grade 3 spleen, no hypotension, not significant hemoperitoneum. Do they stay at your center or do they go? Dr. Long.
Isolated injury?
Rib fractures.
Probably goes.
Okay. Dr. Deutschman.
I would keep a 2 or a 1, but not a 3.
Okay. Dr. Conway.
He'd stay.
Okay. Stay. All right. Okay. All right. So we're going to go negative. So... realities, we've kind of talked about this in the first case, so we're going to keep going. So now we're going to change it back. So, now he drops his blood pressure, pressure's low, diaphoretic and pale. Now what are you going to do?
Operating room.
Go to the operating room. There you go. So can damage control be done in critical access hospitals?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Are there any special considerations that you need before you do that? We've talked about some of these other issues already, so.
Probably just that the recruitment of atypical personnel who are not often in the operating room in our institution may be enlisted to come and lend a hand, hold a retractor. I've had to do that.
Mm-hmm. So thinking outside the box, for those of you who participate or don't participate in the Rural Trauma Team Development Center course, I will tell you it's all about taking those non-typical or atypical people and teaching them to work in the ED environment. But you can bring into that course and expand the scenario and talk about what will we do in the operating room environment. So think about that as you're maturing and doing some of your teaching within your group, or you're asking for some assistance from your level one. So if you don't know what I'm talking about with the RTC course, feel free to contact me at a later time. So splenectomy, packed, open abdomen, transferred to a level one, gets there, we're going to keep moving along. I guess the one thing I would say is, how do you make sure all the lap packs are out? Dr. Knight?
You go look for them. If this patient was operated on and left open, the way I was trained in my fellowship was the patient immediately goes back to the operating room. I think, in practicality, you can make that decision. The patient should go back to the operating room when the patient's ready to go back to the operating room. And that might be right away. It might be that you need to resuscitate the patient a little bit. But I think that, and some of that has to do, too, with the relationships that I have with the surgeons in the community hospitals, as far as my comfort level, I think, is there as well. But when it comes to making sure that the laps are out, I think it's an aggressive look in the operating room. Ideally, if you've talked to the surgeon who did the original operation, they might have some idea about how many have been left in, although I never take that, for face value, just because I've sometimes put laps in and I have no idea how many there are.
Right.
But getting an x-ray on the table before the patient is definitively closed and making sure it's a good quality x-ray where you really clearly see all of the quadrants, because the diaphragm and the liver can be pushed up very high, and really making sure that you have a good view to make sure that the laps are out, I think is really important. And I think the other thing that's important too is, even if you've done this procedure and the surgery at your institution, you don't have to keep that patient. You know, I think doing the operation, getting control of the bleeding, if you've left the bowel in discontinuity, if that's an additional problem or anything like that, there's no concern with sending the patient to us. With those rib fractures, you know, a blossoming of a pulmonary contusion, having difficult ventilator management in a day or two are all real possibilities. So doing the operation and sending the patient right away should be very easy for you to do.
So Keith, I'm going to keep it short here because we want to get to another one before we run out of time. But key thing is when they're physiologically ready to go back, you take them back. Gone are the days of wait 48 hours and all this kind of stuff. So when they're ready to go back, they go back. Fix their shock, get them rewarmed, and then think about taking them back. Take a page out of the military playbook for those of you who are going to do this and transfer them. They were very novel in some of their ways, particularly early on, of writing on the dressing how many, you know, lap packs were in or what they did. And I think for those of us, you know, sometimes there's delay in getting op notes or documentation. That way it's very, very helpful. So think about working with your folks to set that up. Think about having a protocol of how do you document that the laps are out. I will tell you in general, if they're over 300 pounds, then an x-ray itself may not be sufficient to see all the laps. So what we do is if they're over 300 pounds and they come from outside, then they may need to go through the scanner. We now use the RFA chips, but not everybody has that, particularly at the smaller hospital. So in our institution, internally we pack you. We're going to use the RFA wand, but that doesn't work if they come from the outside. You had a comment?
I have just one quick comment about talking to surgeons, is that this is an important opportunity to continue with fellowship and collegiality with the people who help you out going both ways, bidirectional communication. Mm-hmm. There's no substitute for it. You got to develop relationships more than just the pass off of the patient.
Yep. Yet another thing that the RTC will help. So lessons learned on this. All right. Case three.
One quick question. Would you want us to put a chest tube in that patient?
Oh, I put a chest tube in him. Yep, in a heartbeat. I just glossed over that, but yeah.
I was thinking in terms of Dr. Deutschman with the distance and time.
Yep, particularly if they're going to go by air, for sure.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. All right, 28-year-old, trimming a branch, struck on the head, brief LOC, mild confusion, moves everything, awake and alert, GCS 15, can't remember the time, remembers everything else. What are you going to do? Are you going to admit him to your place, image, observe?
We're very conservative. We observe a lot because of the consequence of missing.
Okay. All right. CT of the brain complete, GCS 15, very small subarachnoid. Here, here, here. No blood thinners, no aspirin, no Plavix. Level 3, you're the trauma surgeon. GCS now completely 15, no confusion. Do you keep them? Do you send them? I got some attention there. Yeah, I heard some.
So the state of Alaska just published or issued, I don't know if it's a published issue, but they have a guideline and protocol for their state, just finished in 2017, and it was a collaborative effort, I think, between the University of Washington and the neurosurgeons in Alaska and general trauma surgeons. And they would advocate in this circumstance that it would be okay for the remote areas to keep this patient and observe with guidelines.
Dr. Conway, any thoughts?
So I'm a general surgeon. I'm not a trauma surgeon. I end up covering trauma and doing trauma care all the time. In this instance, with a little bit of blood, I would transfer this patient to neurosurgery.
Okay. So I'm going to add a little editorial comment onto this. There is data that you can safely keep these at a place where you can put them in a monitored environment. The chance of this patient with these scans requiring anything is exceptionally like zero point maybe. I'm sure somebody can look on Google and find something, right? But exceptionally low. But that population is normal mental status, not on blood thinners, right? Not an aneurysm, so trauma-related. So the take-home on this is Know your people. Work out with your level one. This is also a great way if you don't have a sort of tele, you know, consult that you could call. That's another great way to help you work through this. And you may want to think about setting that up, because I can tell you, these patients, they get transferred and they usually go home the next day without even another follow-up scan. So many places feel more comfortable if they have a teleconsult from trauma or neurosurgery they can do. But in a monitored environment with neurochecks with no deterioration, you could argue to keep this patient. Yes, sir.
Asad Taha from Leahy Clinic. And even big centers now, in level one trauma centers, we have the big one, big two, and big three. This belongs to the big one. These people don't get admitted to the hospital. We don't get neurosurgery consult on them, and they don't get follow-up CT scans.
Right.
So these people, even if they are in the middle of Boston, they would go home. You know, after very little things done to them.
Yeah. So I think this is one where having a good relationship, in case you have concerns or worries, having a good relationship is very helpful, but you can feel very comfortable. And I think if they're far from resources and far from help, admitting them for OBS is good. In an urban center, you may not even do that, right? But if they're an hour away from being able to get help, many people would say, great, watch them, and then you can feel even more comfortable. But they don't need follow-up scans. You don't really need a neurosurgeon. But certainly, you got to know your climate. You got to know your backup. But just know you would not be, like, rogue if you did that. So we'll go from there. We're going to skip that. Decision to transfer. Okay, now, same hospital. But now you're at a level three with the neurosurgeon. Same patient comes in with the same mechanism, awake at a scene, but in transport becomes drowsy and arrives at the hospital. Vomits and obtunded, bad weather, you can't fly. Ground is a three-hour drive. He's hypertensive, he's bradycardic, and this is his CT scan, and this is the blood. And here's his little midbrain going, ah, help me, right? What do you do? Level three with a neurosurgeon. Needs a hole in the head, huh? Okay? All right.
Yeah.
You have neurosurgery in a general ICU, not a neurosurgical ICU. Neurosurge says, yep, I get it. Not ideal. I usually do spine, but I agree it's an epidural. Anesthesia is like, we're not comfortable. We're not comfortable. Rick, what do you do? Hold his hand. That's a good answer. So that's it. Rick, go ahead and...
No, I don't...
Our patient's intubated. You got him intubated. They're intubated, but they're like, oh, we're really uncon. Oh, no, we don't do neuro.
That's okay. They can do it. Okay. There's not a long conversation there. It's...
So I think you've eloquently put together exactly what the point is sometimes you got to come in, even though it's not a general surgical problem, and you got to go in and hold their hand figuratively and literally and know that, yes, we have your back. I'll help you if there's any coagulopathy issues. Talk to them about, look, here's the reality. If we don't do this, he is dead for sure. If we do this, yes, it may be a challenge and it may not be ideal. And I know you're stressed. I'll take you out for a beer later. But, you know, we've got to do this, right? So it's important. So what happened, and this was an actual, not this picture, but there was a very similar case that we had in West Virginia. To make it even more complicated, it was a six-year-old. So pediatric neuro on a non-pediatric trained neurosurgeon and a regular anesthesiologist in a center with no ICU even. And, it was a big snowstorm. There was no way they were getting the kid out. And they went in and they had a cordial conversation between all three of them. And they explained to the parents that, you know, yes, this is it. No, I'm not a pediatric subspecialist. No, I don't normally do this, but if we don't do this, the kid's surely going to die. And what happened was they did it and then transferred them to a children's hospital after the epidural was evacuated, when the weather was a little better, when they got to the OR, and the kid was out from that hospital and back in her home environment in 3 days with no neurodeficits and back in school within 4 weeks. So you guys can make a difference, but sometimes it's that emotional intelligence is more needed and more important than your cognitive skills. So, sometimes you have to do stuff out there that isn't the most comfortable, and you got to expand those skill sets. I hope you picked up a few tips on how to expand your skill sets. I hope you can think about some systems and process things that you can put in place. And I hope if you have any questions, you'll feel free to call any of us. And I thank you for what you do every day. You guys are really the front line of taking care of patients throughout the U.S. And keep up the good work and fight the good fight and, go Pens. So.